KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's the kind of thing that's predictable when you run things this way without the usual humanitarian principles.
For the third time in as many days, Palestinians were killed trying to collect emergency food aid in southern Gaza.
It's Tuesday, June 3rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, the National Weather Service is hiring again after the Trump administration cut hundreds of jobs.
Also, how the Conservative Political Action Conference grew into a global coalition of nationalist movements.
The far right is no longer policing itself from white supremacists, you know, disinformation specialists, extremists. They're all in the mix.
And later, an update on the housing market. Why aren't more people buying?
Given the turmoil in government right now, and couple that with the interest rate, it's just become a much less advantageous situation to be in.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration has formally asked Congress to cancel billions of dollars in foreign aid funding. More from NPR's Fatma Tanis.
The White House Office of Management and Budget said in a memo to Congress that the request reflects the administration's need to, quote, cut wasteful foreign assistance. The cuts outlined in the memo include millions in funding for HIV/AIDS and other global health programs, $135 million in funding for the World Health Organization, millions in contributions to the United Nations, and cuts to other programs related to women and gender issues. The process is called a rescission request, and it would codify the slash the administration already made to the United States Agency for International Development earlier this year as it dismantled the aid agency. Congress has 45 days to pass the request, which would only require a simple majority. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Education Secretary Linda McMahon appeared before a Senate subcommittee today. NPR's Corey Turner reports she defended President Trump's latest budget proposal.
Secretary McMahon told senators as she helps close the Department of Education, her goal is clear.
Make education better, fairer, and more accountable by ending federal overreach and empowering families, schools, and states who best know the needs of their students.
The problem for McMahon is that the department's budget proposal would cut funding by 15%, which means eliminating programs that enjoy bipartisan support. For example, Pell Grants for low-income college students would face a steep cut. McMahon also got tough questions from Democrats and Republicans about ending the TRIO and Gear Up programs, which help low-income and first-gen students access college. Corey Turner, NPR News.
The Army has reached its recruiting goal for the year 4 months early. Tom Bowman reports the Army recruited 61,000 future soldiers.
The 61,000 recruits, that's more than 10% above the 55,000 brought in last year, according to Army officials. Recent recruiting momentum has seen average contracts per day exceeding last year's levels by as much as 56%. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll said he was incredibly proud of recruiters and drill sergeants, pointing to what he called President Donald Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's decisive leadership in equipping, training, and supporting the future soldiers. The administration has said the president's election has led to a so-called Trump bump in recruiting, but the Army says changes in its recruiting efforts have led to jumps in recruiting for more than 2 years. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
President Trump has signed an executive order boosting tariffs on imported steel and aluminum to a total of 50%, with those new higher tariffs expected to go into effect tomorrow. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street. The Dow is up 214 points. This is NPR. A day after Ukraine launched a drone strike that is reported destroyed a number of Russian warplanes and other facilities, Russia appears to have retaliated with a rocket attack against the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy. Authorities there say the attack killed at least four people and wounded more than two dozen others. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the attack shows Russia has no intentions of ending the now three-year-old war. Local authorities say the rocket barrage hit apartment buildings and a medical facility in the center of the city. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Secret Service says it blew up a key bridge. In a year of tariff turmoil, some shoppers are tightening budgets, but one company stands apart from many retailers because it is forecasting a better year ahead. That company's Dollar General, the largest dollar store chain in the U.S. Here's NPR's Alina Selyuk.
Historically, dollar stores thrive during tough economic times as more people look for cheaper places to shop. At Dollar General so far this year, sales in the latest quarter rose 2.4% from last year, leading to a higher sales forecast for the rest of the year. Executives say shoppers are trading down from more expensive stores. They're seeing more lower-income and middle-income shoppers. In company surveys, two-thirds of Dollar General shoppers say they expect to cut back spending this year even on necessities. Dollar General officials say they hope to mitigate tariff costs but might have to raise prices as a last resort. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices continue to gain ground amid ongoing tensions between oil producer Russia and Ukraine. Oil up 89 cents a barrel to $63.41 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This morning brought another mass casualty event near a food distribution site in Gaza, the third in as many days. This time, more than two dozen people were killed as they tried to collect emergency food aid, according to Gaza health officials and the International Committee of the Red Cross. Witnesses say the Israeli military fired on the crowd. The military acknowledged firing warning shots at, quote, several suspects moving toward their position, and fired additional shots at individual suspects who they said did not retreat. The violence may have something to do with the way Israel is managing food distribution in Gaza. It's not how aid is typically given out in war zones. To explain, we're joined by Avril Benoit. She is CEO of Doctors Without Borders within the U.S. and has helped distribute aid in conflict zones around the world. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
So these food distribution sites in southern Gaza are not run by the UN or other well-established international aid organizations. A private group backed by the U.S. is overseeing the effort. How unusual is that?
Very unusual. So this food distribution scheme is coordinated by something called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, created by the U.S. and Israel, not just backed, but it's been disastrous. In the first afternoon of the distribution in Rafah, people were shot, injured. You can imagine, after so many weeks and months of siege, just to fight to get scraps of food to survive, it's the kind of thing that's predictable when you run things this way without the usual humanitarian principles, which involve a certain expertise, but also notions of impartiality, making sure that the aid isn't politicized, that you're not militarizing aid, which is very much the whole concept here.
You say this is predictable when you run things this way. Can you be more specific? What do you see this organization doing that a group like the UN would not do?
This is a cynical ploy, if you will, to feign compliance with international humanitarian law, to say, look, we have this humanitarian foundation, it's delivering food. But for all my years working in humanitarian crisis zones, I've never seen a three-month siege.
For about 3 months, Israel did not deliver food to the Gaza Strip, is what you're referring to.
Yes. I mean, even the number of trucks that are getting in are paltry compared to what's needed. We have, as Doctors Without Borders, over 106 trucks waiting authorization to cross. And they contain medical items, you know, painkillers, antibiotics, saline, compress, gauzes, things like that. But in a food distribution, normally you would do it in an impartial way. You don't ask people to risk their lives to get it. You try to reach people where the aid is most needed.
As opposed to asking people to reach you. Yeah.
Exactly.
In any war zone where people are at risk of starvation, there is going to be security concerns, there is going to be the risk of panic and chaos. How is that typically mitigated in aid distribution sites in conflict zones?
Well, the first step is not to withdraw it, and not to withhold it, not to block it, so that people are so desperate. I mean, that's the first step. Now, understandably, in many conflict zones, that's not the case. Think of Sudan, where you have very high levels of malnutrition, even famine, and it's so insecure that the World Food Program and other delivery systems have just been unable to reach people. But in a situation like this, is very much under the control of Israeli military operations, with intensified airstrikes, widespread evacuation orders, one after the other. So it's, for me, it's quite obviously a situation of violence and panic that is entirely human-made. It's not surprising that people who are suffering so much will take risks also to be able to feed themselves and their children.
Israel controls all aid into Gaza. Do you see a diplomatic path for the UN and other experienced aid organizations like yours to resume the work that you've done in other parts of the world in Gaza in the past?
Well, it just has to. It has to. I mean, there's just no way around it. Think of...
Well, I mean, I don't know that Netanyahu will respond to someone saying it has to. Is there a way to persuade the Israeli government of what you're saying?
Well, look, what we have under the circumstances now are what many would say is exactly what Israel was warned not to do, which is to create conditions of genocide, or to manage this conflict in a way that creates, you know, violations of international law, such as the mass starving of people. And withholding humanitarian aid from them. Obviously, it's a very complex situation politically. I'm not an expert in that. Our organization doesn't weigh into this. If we're political at all, it's just to speak for people's right to survive. What we need is for this violence to stop, for people to be able to receive aid. We're currently working under unbearable conditions. Even our own staff are barely eating one meal a day. And it's, you know, for us, it's just an unbearable situation of violence.
Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In a statement, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which runs the new aid sites, recognized, quote, a number of civilians were injured today, quote, well beyond our secure distribution site. Israel strenuously denies accusations of genocide. Many people looking to buy a home are having second thoughts right now about signing on the dotted line. Plenty of things are getting in the way. High prices, high interest rates, and economic and political worries. NPR's Laurel Wamsley spoke with a couple of those would-be buyers who say the direction of the political winds has unnerved them and caused them to put their searches on hold.
Dee and his wife are federal contractors in their early 40s. They live just outside Boston in a two-bedroom condo they bought 13 years ago. They don't need to move, but they would love to have a yard.
It's fine, but we'd like to have an American dream place of our own, white picket fence yard, grow some vegetables.
Dee asked that we not use his name out of fear of harassment for speaking with the media. The spring would have been a good time for them to buy, since they've got down payment money and a lot of homes have been hitting the market. But instead, their search is on hold for the foreseeable.
Given the turmoil in government right now and trying to assess that, we've pretty much given up. And then couple that with the interest rate, it's just become a much less advantageous situation to be in terms of housing purchases.
Mortgage rates are now approaching 7%. And given the mass firings of federal workers and cancellation of government contracts under the Trump administration, Dee says it's hard to know whether their jobs are safe.
So far, it's looking like it's going to be okay, but who knows? The concern comes and goes with each press release.
And uncertainty doesn't make people want to plonk down their savings and take on a 30-year loan. Hundreds of miles away, 35-year-old Jeffrey and his husband had been shopping for a home in Dayton, Ohio, where they've been living for 5 years.
This would have been our first time buying a house.
But those plans have changed as he's watched President Trump strip away civil rights protections and sign executive orders on DEI and gender identity. Jeffrey says he feels like, as a gay couple, their rights could be the next to go.
If they're coming for trans people, if they're coming for people of color, like, how is it not going to get to gay people, you know?
Jeffrey asked that his full name not be used, out of fear for his safety. The couple had been feeling ready to put down roots in Dayton, but he's been dismayed to see Ohio's legislature embracing Trump's agenda, passing laws including a transgender bathroom and sports ban. A ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth is in effect while a legal challenge plays out. So their plan to buy has been replaced by more existential concerns. And now the couple is looking at moving out of the country entirely.
It's hard to have any sort of future plan when things feel so unstable, and like an executive order can just be passed on a whim that could attack my rights. It's very overwhelming.
While most of those who talk about it aren't moving to Canada just yet, all the political and economic uncertainty is contributing to slow U.S. home sales this spring. This April saw the slowest existing home sales of any April in 16 years. And May's numbers are looking meager too, as pending sales also slipped. It's a tough time to buy a home. And for some people, the political situation is another reason to wait. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
After public backlash, the National Weather Service says it will begin hiring new employees to stabilize operations at its field offices around the country. NPR's Greg Allen reports that after cuts ordered by the Trump administration this year, the Weather Service lost nearly 600 positions.
The National Weather Service says the job cuts left some of the more than 100 field offices around the country no longer staffed around the clock, and some also cut back on weather balloon launches. Tom Fahey, who's with the union that represents the Weather Service employees, says the agency will be filling 126 new positions, among them meteorologist, hydrologist, physical scientist, and electronic technician, a position that's especially critical.
Electronic technicians are those individuals that take care of the radar, weather radars, and the sensitive weather equipment that's at every weather forecast office and at mobile sites around the country.
To cover staff shortages, the Weather Service has been temporarily assigning employees to field offices around the country. Mary Glacken, a former undersecretary at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Weather Service's parent agency, says the announcement of the new hires is an admission by the administration that the job cuts went too far.
We're in the middle of a severe weather season, and I know that that's put quite a strain on the system that they have there. And, of course, the hurricane season started with the first of this month. You know, it's not a good time to be understaffed.
Blacken says from her experience, filling positions at NOAA can take months. She expects will be September at the earliest before many of the jobs are filled. And she notes after the cuts earlier this year, the Weather Service is still short several hundred positions.
So, you know, this is kind of putting a Band-Aid on a rather large wound.
Fahey says he expects that some of the probationary Weather Service employees recently terminated may reapply for the positions, some of which they may have already been trained and certified for. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Republican lawmakers' tax and spending package could touch many aspects of Americans' lives, including maybe what you drive. That's because the bill, which is now being discussed in the Senate, would roll back the tax incentives that the Biden administration signed into law to encourage buying electric vehicles. NPR's Camila Domonoske has the details. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Camila, if this bill passes, what can it mean for car shoppers?
Yeah, based on the version that came out of the House, the credit for buying a used electric vehicle, which is worth up to $4,000 for qualifying people, that would go away at the end of this year. And the credit for new EVs, which is worth up to $7,500, that would get very narrow. It would apply to fewer cars next year and then go away completely at the end of 2026. You know, not just for electric vehicles, but for clean energy more broadly, a lot of advocates say that this proposed package is pretty close to a full repeal of the tax credits that were added under the Biden administration. And on top of that, this would add a new fee for electric vehicle owners, $250 every year. That's described as something that would make up for the gas taxes that EV drivers don't pay, but it's a lot more than people who drive gas cars typically pay in gas taxes.
Okay, help us understand the logic behind removing these incentives.
Certainly, a lot of Republican lawmakers objected strongly to these tax credits when they were first added or expanded by Democrats in their big climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act. We saw GOP lawmakers call it wasteful, say that it's simply not the government's business to try to incentivize one kind of car over another. These credits have also been critiqued for mostly helping wealthier families because new vehicles at all, and electric vehicles in general, are simply so expensive that that's who can afford them. That is something that the used car credit was, in fact, meant to address. And kind of ironically, this Republican tax package overall would itself benefit the wealthiest Americans and hurt the poorest. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office. And, you know, that is another element of what's happening here, which is all these tax cuts in the package are expensive for the government. Lawmakers have to find money somewhere to at least partially offset them. And EV tax credits are an easy target.
Well, I mean, didn't President Trump, as a candidate, campaign against former President Biden's EV policy? So have automakers been preparing for this at all?
Right. It's not totally shocking. But first of all, it is simply difficult for car makers to adapt to a U-turn that is this rapid. We're talking about an industry that plans things years in advance. And secondly, there was some hope that Republicans would actually defend these tax credits. And that's because Republican districts in particular have benefited from them. The new manufacturing that these EV tax credits helped spur is largely going into districts that lean red, and there are jobs on the line. Companies and EV advocates are certainly making that case to senators as they deliberate, but I spoke with Levi McAllister, a Morgan Lewis lawyer who focuses on EVs.
I think companies are finally starting to say, hey, for us to plan, we need to assume all of this, all of it's going away, and we have to plan it with that environment in mind.
So, Camila, if these incentives do all go away, well, what would this mean for the future of electric vehicles?
Well, companies will still make them. They're betting that EVs will get better, cheaper, a lot more people will want them in the future. And importantly, the rest of the world is still moving in this direction, and companies don't want to get left behind. But it will really affect the pace that affects these manufacturing projects, and it affects efforts to meet climate goals, which was the logic behind these incentives in the first place, right? That reducing reliance on gasoline is crucial to slowing the damage from climate change.
NPR's Camila Domonoske, thank you.
Thanks.
South Korea's opposition party candidate has won the country's presidential election by a solid margin. The snap election comes after 6 months of chaos, triggered by the declaration of martial law and the previous president's impeachment. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul.
In his victory speech, Lee Jae-myung pledged to restore democracy to South Korea.
여러분이
The first mission you gave me is to overcome the insurrection once and for all, he said, to ensure that there will never again be a military coup that threatens the people. Martial law was a key issue for many voters. Outside one polling place, we spoke to Park Song-hui, 32. She said that in the last election in 2022, she voted for a liberal third-party candidate who fit her feminist views. Instead, Yoon Song-yeol was elected, and he declared martial law. Park says this made her regret voting for a minor party candidate.
I think waking up to find your country in flames would be enough to make anyone rethink their choice.
So in this election, Park voted for Lee Jae-myung, thinking that he was not an ideal choice, but a realistic one.
I felt I should vote for someone from a party with the power to keep me alive and protect my safety as a woman.
While conservative administrations have focused on deterrence against North Korea, Lee Jae-myung has promised diplomatic engagement with Pyongyang. But that doesn't go over so well with some older voters whose views were shaped by the legacy of the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. 60-year-old Nam Kyung-won says she went to a school built on a former Korean War battleground. Her school's principal told students that the spirits of patriots rested beneath their feet. Nam remembers seeing South Korean soldiers' remains exhumed from the school grounds.
Seeing the bones made me realize what the principal said was true, that there were people like me who died trying to save the country lying right there.
Nam said that experience never left her, and her views of North Korea haven't changed.
I think that really engraved in me that after growing up and playing in a school with such a sad history, I could never support those who collaborate with or endorse North Korea.
Lee Jae-myung has promised to engage with North Korea, but he's also pledged to keep South Korea's alliance with the U.S. ironclad. So Jong-gon is a political scientist at Kyunghee University in Seoul. He says that while Lee has proposed reaching out to North Korea, his campaign is focused more on bread-and-butter issues. That's partly because North Korea appears unwilling to either engage with South Korea or give up its nuclear weapons.
North Korea denuclearization is not thinkable anymore. I mean, that is a huge factor for any new leadership in South Korea to talk more and more about domestic politics and the economy.
Lee Jae-myung has similarly not spelled out how he plans to deal with the Trump administration's tariffs or its prioritizing confronting China. Saw says that South Korea hasn't really figured out President Trump's intentions, much less how it should respond to them.
I don't think we are ready to sort of lay out the Korean version of foreign policy towards the 2.0 Trump administration.
He notes that Lee's experience as a mayor and provincial governor has made him into a more pragmatic administrator than some of his liberal colleagues. But it's hard to know how liberal or centrist Lee will really be, Saw says, until he takes office. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
This is NPR News.
The governor's mansion in Pennsylvania set on fire, the killing of two Israeli embassy workers in D.C., and an attack on a group raising awareness for Israeli hostages. It all raises a question: is the threat from extremism rising?
The connective tissue for extremism in the U.S. is anti-Semitism.
An expert on counterterrorism assesses this moment. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. When the series The L Word premiered in 2004, it was groundbreaking, one of the first to focus on the lives of queer female characters.
Nothing has ever filled its place, and you'd think it would after all this time, but nothing had.
We'll speak with two of the show's stars after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Elon Musk today slammed the Republicans' huge spending bill, the vehicle for President Trump's domestic agenda, that passed the House by just one vote and now is in the Senate. Musk called it an abomination. That is Democrats happy. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says he and Musk are on the same page, and he goes on to quote him.
Elon Musk and I agree with each other. The GOP tax scam is a disgusting abomination. Every single Republican who voted for the one big, ugly bill should be ashamed of themselves.
House Speaker Mike Johnson said Musk's comments were terribly wrong and very disappointing. President Trump is pressing Republican senators to pass the bill, but many say it can't pass in its current form. As Trump touts his own executive orders to lower drug prices, Medicare drug price negotiations begun during the Biden administration are continuing behind the scenes. NPR's Sydney Lupkin has more.
Two drug makers, Amgen and Novo Nordisk, which sells Ozempic, confirmed to NPR that they had received opening price offers from the government, kicking off negotiations that could last through October. Medicare drug price negotiation is still relatively new. Until the 2022 passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, Medicare Part D, which covers more than 50 million seniors, didn't have the authority to negotiate drug prices. The program reached lower prices for its first 10 drugs last year. This is the second round of bargaining. Lower prices negotiated this time would take effect in January 2027. The Department of Health and Human Services did not respond to a request for comment. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading flat at this hour, but by the close, they were higher. Dow was up 214 points, Nasdaq up 156. This is NPR News. The U.S.'s new ambassador to China met with China's top diplomat in Beijing at a time that China's foreign minister calls a critical juncture. This week, the U.S. and China accused each other of breaking a trade truce. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
Businessman David Perdue was confirmed as U.S. ambassador to China last month. And at his meeting this week with Foreign Minister Wang Yi, Wang said Perdue needed to get relations on, quote, the right track. The U.S. temporarily paused most of its 145% tariffs on China last month, and China followed suit. But both countries say the other has violated that trade truce, the U.S. by limiting certain critical software to Chinese semiconductor companies, and China by failing to allow rare earth exports to ramp up. Perdue is a longtime business executive and former Georgia senator who has long relied on global trade and outsourcing to Asia, but has come to support a more hawkish stance against China. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Meta cut a 20-year deal to secure nuclear power to help meet surging demand for artificial intelligence and other computing needs at Facebook's parent company. The investment also expands the output of a Constellation Energy nuclear plant in Illinois. It's the latest in a string of tech nuclear partnerships as the use of AI expands. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. For decades, the Conservative Political Action Conference was an annual D.C. fixture, but in recent years, it has gone international. Last week, there was not one, but two CPACs in Hungary and Poland. And the range of speakers is a window into the growing global coalition of nationalist movements. NPR's Huo Jingnan has the story.
This year, President Trump's second term energized the European CPAC conferences. Here's far-right Austrian politician Herbert Kickl.
Fight, 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 and knock the globalists out.
Days before a presidential election in Poland, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem endorsed the pro-Trump right-wing candidate at CPAC Poland. That candidate went on to win this past weekend.
President Trump knows that the West has the will to survive because of you.
Nationalist parties didn't always get together so publicly, says Duncan MacDonald.
They were literally afraid to be seen together 15 years ago.
He's a professor of politics at Griffith University in Australia and studies nationalist and populist parties around the world.
And I've interviewed them a lot about this. They thought that their national media would say, hey, you know, you've been seen with Jean-Marie Le Pen, he's anti-Semitic, he's extreme, therefore, so are you.
In just over a decade, what used to be fringe is now on a live stream and includes members of the U.S. government. Among the other speakers this year was Dutch influencer Eva Vladingerbroek, who brought up a conspiracy theory that has inspired multiple terror attacks.
I wanted the whole world to know that the Great Replacement Theory was in fact not a theory, but reality. White people are becoming a minority in their own homelands at an exceptionally fast rate.
Therefore, she says, all people who are not white need to be expelled from Europe or re-migrate to the countries where they or their ancestors were born. The Trump administration has embraced the idea and wants to create an Office of Re-Migration in the State Department. Also in the mix were leaders of German and Polish political parties that have used Nazi slogans, symbols, and salutes. Heidi Barak has been watching who shows up at CPAC. She runs the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism.
It shows once again that the far right is no longer policing itself from white supremacists, you know, disinformation specialists, extremists, that they're all in the mix.
Multiple Israelis with ties to its government were also at the conference in Hungary. A goal they share with the other figures, driving out Muslims. Here's Amihai Shikli, Minister for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism. He appeared to refer to a rape case in Paris last year.
The 12-year-old Jewish girl in France was not raped by Frenchmen, but by Islamist barbarians.
The suspects were boys under 15, and authorities have not released information about their nationality or religion. Alice Weidel leads Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, which made big gains in recent elections.
When it comes to the daily horrors of imported migrant violence and Islamist terror on the streets, our chancellor remains silent.
Like many Trump supporters, the speakers talked about fighting the deep state and globalists, which is often a dog whistle for Jews. Some of their other shared goals include targeting transgender people and elevating the role of Christianity, often in the name of, quote, defending Western civilization. That idea became more prominent once the U.S. joined the coalition during Trump's first term, says MacDonald.
For a long time, they've been talking about defending Europe, but that language didn't work anymore once the U.S. came in. So it made more sense to find a larger umbrella identity.
More important than the speeches on stage, MacDonald says, is the networking that happens off stage. One thing the Europeans have shown Americans, he says, is how to build and expand nationalist movements over decades. Huo Jingnan, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's Wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Rami Youssef rose to fame for his semi-autobiographical Hulu series, Rami. Lately, he's branched out into roles that do not draw from his personal life, like in HBO's Mountain Head. Youssef plays one of four tech executives holed up in a mountain resort as a global crisis unfolds. He says he was drawn to how the script grappled with the ways technology is blowing up old power dynamics.
For a long time, we've had this dynamic of power versus people, and then now entering the conversation is the tech. And in a way, what we start to understand in this story is just, that has a mind of its own. And what is that going to do?
When Youssef sat down with Wildcard host Rachel Martin, he shared more of his personal history, including his relationship with his parents.
Was there a moment when you started seeing your parents as people?
Wow. Yeah. I think when I saw my grandfather, my father's father, pass, my dad shifted into a whole different role after his father passed. Because, you know, I think it's that thing of, well, yeah, now that in my life, I am the elder, you know, but I saw my dad go through that. And I remember thinking, oh, whoa, you know, he's a son like I am.
Yeah.
And he was a kid. And I think I knew these things, but there was something about that moment
totally.
Where I really felt it. And then I started to see everything that they were dealing with us, with a whole different kind of compassion, even if I felt, you know, like all kids do that, you know, why do I have any guardrails or why are you, you know, telling me, you know, you could have all those frustrations, but I really did understand it, you know, through a different lens.
When that happens, you lose some of, if you have a relationship where you put your parents on a pedestal, I did to some degree, and then you see them emote like a human,
yeah.
not, and in that as a vulnerability, does that, I don't know, was there a grief associated for yourself of seeing your dad not lose stature, but just become vulnerable that way to you?
It was vulnerable is the perfect word, because there was no stature loss. If anything, I almost feel like I loved him and my mother even more, you know, because when you're a kid, you kind of, if you're lucky, you know death as a concept, but you don't have to know it too intimately. And then when you start to know it, you start to feel, oh, wow, well, I really want to love as much as I can while I can.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, you don't want to have the thought, but algebraically you go, okay, then, you know, I'll lose him at some point. But yeah, so that was really, oh, yeah, these are people, you know.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. And you can see Rami Youssef in Mountain Head on HBO Max now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. There are 9,000 public libraries in the United States, excluding branches and bookmobiles. About two-thirds are in rural areas or towns, according to federal data. For years, the Institute of Museum and Library Services has supported them. However, cuts by the Trump administration could jeopardize the future of rural libraries in particular. Emily Hayes with member station Illinois Public Media reports.
Greenup is a small town in central Illinois. The township's public library is basically one large room.
You're welcome to take a look around, or yeah. I can walk you through.
Vicki Pierce is the circulation clerk.
We've divided our children's, our adults, but our movies are here.
Pierce has worked here for 8 years after retiring as an English teacher. She's one of three part-time employees.
We're a small town library, so really small budget. And honestly, I'm not sure how we managed to stay open.
Part of how they stay open is through grants from the independent federal agency, the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Before the pandemic, the federal government covered around 5% of GreenUp Library's operating costs. Kate McDowell is a professor at the University of Illinois School of Information Sciences. She says the IMLS is a very small agency
that has impacts on almost every community in the whole of the United States and territories.
Public libraries get most of their funding from county and city taxes. IMLS distributes the majority of federal library funds. McDowell says the grants vary year to year and are often small, but they help libraries try new things.
What the IMLS funds is not just the subsistence of libraries, although that's there too, it's their future.
IMLS gave out $267 million last year to libraries and museums. That's 0.3% of federal spending. But the future of that funding is in doubt. In March, almost all of the IMLS staff were put on administrative leave. In an executive order, President Trump claimed the move would reduce unnecessary bureaucracy. GreenUp isn't expecting any federal money this year, and Pierce says the library is financially cautious.
We squeeze every penny 3 or 4 or 5 times to get the most out of it.
And Pierce says the idea of taking more money away from libraries sickens her. The American Library Association says that's been happening nationwide to libraries and museums receiving IMLS grants.
GreenUp Library, this is Vicki.
Pierce picks up the phone and talks to an elderly yes. patron who can't make it to the library.
Yes. Do you want me to check it out and bring it by?
Pierce says she wants people to use the library, so she's happy to go out of her way. Meanwhile, in another section of the library, Shauna Ridgely is going through a box of books that are part of the library's spring sale. She and her mother were both librarians, and Ridgely says her mom instilled both a love of reading in her and a love for libraries.
As a parent, you can go in and you can say yes. So if the kid wants to have 10 books to take home, you can say yes, and it's not going to cost you anything.
She's less certain about what the Trump administration should or should not do when it comes to providing grants for libraries. Still, she sees the value in cutting government spending.
I'm a very budget-oriented person, so the fact that we are trillions of dollars in debt makes me ill.
However, a judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from dismantling the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Congress has funded the department through September. For now, GreenUp Library says it's still providing the same services. But that could change for it and other rural libraries. For NPR News, I'm Emily Hayes in Urbana, Illinois.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. By the early 2000s, only a handful of queer female characters had ever been featured on television. So just imagine the buzz when The L Word premiered in 2004.
Okay. Melanie slept with Heather.
Okay.
Heather slept with Brooke.
Heather slept with Brooke?
Yes.
Brooke slept with Nina.
And I slept with Nina. See that?
Wow, yeah.
So four. One. That is how many people it takes to link you to me.
Over six seasons in a 2019 reboot, The L Word explored lesbian identity, friendship, and sex with nuance, humor, and a whole bunch of drama. Leisha Haley and Kate Menig starred in The L Word as Alice and Shane, and they are the authors of a new memoir. It's called So Gay for You, Friendship Found Family, and the Show That Started It All. Leisha, Kate, welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, goodness. Thank you for having
us. Thank you so much for having us. We're thrilled to be here.
I got to just start off by saying that you have lit up several of my group chats who are just so excited to have this conversation. I mean, The L Word for so many of us was a show that we found community around, we found family around, and even so many years removed, that seems to be the case now. What do you think it is about The L Word that has been so enduring for so many people?
Isn't that wild? It's still connecting.
And it still means something to us to talk about, right?
Maybe it's because nothing has ever filled its place. And you'd think it would after all this time, but nothing had.
It also was about the friendships.
Yeah.
And I think that surprised a lot of people. Like, a lot of straight people watched the show as well, because that's what they identified with.
Also, it was the first.
Yeah. You can't beat the first of anything.
And that certainly might add to it.
I want to start by talking a little bit about your origin story. You guys met in the casting process for the show. You were both up for the same part to play the character Shane, which Kate ended up portraying. And there's this sort of immediate magnetism between the two of you that you describe in the book. I'll let you pick up the story from here.
Well, that is a true story. We were both testing. It was actually the last phase of the audition process.
We were the only two.
And it's shocking to people, including myself, that I was up for that part, because I can't imagine it being played by anyone but Kate.
Maybe in a Black Mirror episode, it's going to switch where you can, and then maybe I play a version of Alice.
Oh, never thought of that.
Yeah.
It took a long time before there was another show quite like this, and I wonder if you feel like when you look at our films, our media, or even our music to some degree, if there's a more well-rounded representation of queer people.
Yes.
I felt like it was quite one note in the pre-L Word era, at least
yes,
in my opinion.
I mean, I think, like, if you think of just like a power lesbian, let's just talk about that for a second. It was very corporate. It was career-driven, like the suits, and it just felt like, and I'm not going to say one note, but it was like, oh, a woman who walks in and knows what she wants. And now I feel like the idea of a power lesbian would be more inclusive and more fluid. I feel like queer characters are more well-rounded. I just don't think we have reached the goal yet where we have enough queer characters on television. So we're always left with these crumbs, and we're supposed to be so happy every time we see one. And of course we are, but I just think there's so much work to be done.
One thing the show did back then was break cliches.
Mm-hmm.
And I can speak for Shane as an example. No one really understood what that character was until she landed on screen, and then it started to make sense. And I think that's because she's an example of breaking a cliche. Like, if you're boyish, or if you sort of lean more masculine, less feminine, you're considered butch. It's like, well, that's not necessarily true.
It was very binary back then.
It was binary.
And,
so
now I think
there's more of like this beautiful arch of where you can fall in that.
I mean, I do have to ask you, do you think you'd ever revisit those characters again? I know, of course, there was the Generation Q reboot, but will we ever see an Alice or a Shane?
Well, we never say never, but we don't own the brand or the IP, or we have no say in it.
Who knows? I mean, we had a reboot one time. Maybe in 20 years, they're going to want to do L Word hospice care. You never know.
When I started reading the book, I took the opportunity to rewatch some of the episodes of the show, which I've done from time to time over the years.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And there's so much in it that I love, but there are also some other parts that don't stand the test of time as well. And Leisha, you wrote about the way that the show mirrored the cultural attitudes at the time towards bisexuality, and the way that the show understood the gender spectrum was also pretty fraught. And you've said that some scenes in the way that trans and non-binary people were treated fill you with shame. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't take responsibility for the lines I had to say or some of the scenes we all had to act, because I would say all of us said things that were offensive. But I don't like that I was a part of that. I can't change where we were at the time. The writers were only using the language they had at the time. Mm-hmm. I do think, however, we were the first show to put those kinds of people on screen. So I'm both proud and ashamed at the same time. It depends which scene we're talking about. I know there were times where even Shane and Alice would completely be dismissive to Max, the character, as though he didn't exist or what he was trying to say didn't matter. It's that sort of ghosting, in a way, mm-hmm. of someone's identity.
Mm-hmm.
I want to circle back to where we started, which is talking about your friendship. I know that the two of you also have a podcast that is rooted in your friendship. It's called Pants with Kate and Leisha. Can you just tell us about the name?
Well, Pants came from Mia Kirshner, who played Jenny, because Leisha and I were like two glue sticks stuck together. And one day Mia saw us and she had a light bulb go off and she said, "Oh, look, it's Pants." And we said, "What does that mean?" She's like, "You're like a pair of pants. You can't have one leg without the other." And we thought initially it was an insult. And then when we actually had the image in our head, we're like, "Actually, no, that makes sense." Cut to 15, 20 years later, and this podcast idea came to us, and we had to come up with a name. And Leisha goes, "Remember Pants?" And I was like, that's it. That's the answer.
Just listening to the two of you talk about your friendship, I love that there's this magic between the two of you, but you have made it so clear that it's not always some sort of fairy tale and that maintaining a decades-long friendship takes work. I wonder if you could just tell us maybe one thing from each of you. What's the key to making it work for all these years?
I use the word consistency a lot because I think without it, things can die on the vine, especially when it's a friendship. And especially as you get older and you have different responsibilities than you did when you were in your 20s.
I think also I've learned to be more vulnerable with Kate. We put so much concentration on, you know, significant others or home life, but sometimes friendships take more work.
And also friendships are the perfect medicine. Sometimes it's just, it is. Like there are times where I'm having a day, whatever kind of day that is. And nothing's really scratching that itch. And then you and I will hop on the phone and it's the perfect antidote. Whew. And now I move on.
We have been speaking with Leisha Haley and Kate Minnig, the authors of the memoir, So Gay for You. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Girls in tight dresses who drag with mustaches.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options, designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at Viking.com.